Welcome to Cooking the Books, an interview series about food and fiction. I'm your host, Alia Dibodard.
And I'm your host, Fran Wild. Carmen, we're so glad to have you here today. We've got some great questions, so we're just going to get rolling.
Awesome. Can you tell us, our readers, a little bit about your collection, Her Body and Other Parties, about the stories there and what stitches it together?
Yeah, actually, stitches is a funny word in this context. So it's a short story collection with a series of liminally genred stories with some different genres that deal with the oppressed body, women's bodies and queer bodies in particular, and sort of women's lives and minds and bodies and how they all sort of connect to each other. And there's some horror, science fiction, fantasy, just some pop culture in there. Sorry, it's hard to describe that book.
Her Body and Other Parties comes out on October 3rd, and there is a big party at the Philadelphia Public Library with Jennifer Egan. So the book, which is a collection of short stories, many that have been previously published elsewhere, but several of which that are absolutely new, has already become an Indie Next pick, a National Book Award longlister, and a Kirkus Prize nominee, among many fabulous recognitions for your work. Congratulations. So what do you think of all of this? It's pretty marvelous.
I'm a little bit in shock. I mean, obviously, I'm extremely excited. I feel really this Grey Wolf has done such an amazing job with this book. I couldn't be happier. So yeah, but I'm a little in shock. I'm very excited. And I think it's still kind of all soaking in. It feels weird, especially because the book hasn't come out yet. So I feel like it's not quite real. I think maybe after the book has actually come out, it'll feel slightly more real.
When you get to hold it and read it in front of people, you've already got your author copy, so you can do that now, but it's still in front of an audience in an auditorium. It's a pretty great feeling.
I mean, when I got it, I like smelled it a lot because it smells like a real book. I kept like sniffing it.
For me, it was actually seeing it on bookshelves.
Yeah.
So my God, this is a real book kind of thing. Like,
yeah, okay. I think that's going to be its own experience too, is seeing it like in a bookstore, which has not happened yet. But
I cannot wait for the Instagram of Carmen going to all the bookstores and taking a picture.
You better believe it.
So many selfies.
The shelfie, yes.
So many shelfies, exactly.
So I was really fascinated by, when I was reading through the stories, I saw that you often have stories about people being food, whether they turn into food through fascination or whether it's literal for the consumption of others. For instance, you have in The Husband's Ditch, you have the woman who carves out her liver and feeds it to her husband, essentially, while being unaware that she's doing this. Can you talk a little about that theme?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I just started listening to this really great podcast called Racist Sandwich, which I don't know if either of you have listened to it.
I have.
If you haven't, I highly recommend it. It's a really good podcast about race and food. And so I've been especially thinking politically about, you know, it's funny because like food is such a political thing. And oftentimes when food gets described in the context of politics, people are like, it's just food. Like, what's the big deal? But like, it's like so political, right? Because it's like, everybody has to eat. Everybody produces food. Like, that's like a really essential sort of part of our political landscape is like, who makes food, who eats the food, how it gets made, who makes it, who gets recognition for making it. So I feel like the idea of like creation and consumption is like a very sort of inherently political idea. And so in my book, I'm somebody who like loves food. I love cooking and I'm like really interested in how that sort of metaphor of consumption can sort of be played out in various ways. So, right, you have like the woman eating her own liver in The Husband's Ditch. You have like the woman in the pretzel dough, like in the Real Women Have Bodies. Like, I'm just really interested in like what that means and like in a more sort of like almost like, I mean, the fabulism gives me sort of room to like make that a little more literal, which I sort of like. And I'm also interested in like, I mean, food and also in terms of like gender, right? And like just thinking about like all the women I've known who like make food for other people. So yeah, I feel like all this stuff is kind of tied together and it's really interesting to me. And of course, like liminal fantasy gives me some space to like sort of, you know, play with that.
Okay. We've got a lot more questions on that topic. Our media partners, the Book Smugglers, also wanted to ask you questions. They had a lot of questions. So we're going to ask a couple of them today, and then we're going to send you several others so that you can provide written answers to them. So
I love that.
We're sort of cross-media platforming right now. But Anna Antea asked, your stories had such a huge impact on us for the incredible way that you mix speculative fiction and the reality of women's lives. And it struck us how sometimes the speculative aspect is subtle to the point where the absurdity and profundity of what's happening to the women appear as speculative instead. Can you talk a bit about that?
Wow, that's a great question.
They ask great questions.
Well, that's an amazing question. One of the reasons I'm really drawn to liminal fantasy as opposed to other subgenres of fantasy is, I feel like we already exist in this liminal space. And so I feel like we're already in this sort of absurd, like we already exist in a liminal space. I feel like with a lot of my stories, I'm not doing very much in terms of amping up the unreality or amping up the sort of fabulous element. I mean, I think women's lives are sort of absurdist, not absurd, but like absurdist in the sense of like, we are just sort of like powering through all this like chaos and nightmare. And it's like almost funny. It's terrible, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And so, so I sort of feel like that's just sort of the tone that I'm engaging with or I'm trying to engage with.
The word liminal keeps coming up. It's one of my favorite words, but I think that you're playing with the barrier of what sort of public reality is versus what women's reality is as well. And so crossing that threshold and bringing the story across does sometimes seem like, wow, this is kind of a nightmare. And everybody who's reading it who has had that experience is like, no, this is normal. This is completely normal.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I just feel like I don't think of it as fabulous as people sort of say, if that makes any sense. Like I that's just like the kind of work that interests me as a reader as well. I mean, that's why I'm just so interested in that space.
I really like and recognize the fact that you are using the term fabulous instead of magical realism.
You know, I have a lot of thoughts about that, about the phrase magical realism. And they're a little half-baked, so you'll have to forgive me. I feel like magical realism is a very specific, it's a very specific tradition that I absolutely read, but I don't think I come from that literary tradition, and so I hesitate to use that phrase. People sometimes use it to describe my work, but I tend to prefer, like, fabulous or, like, liminal fantasy, just because I feel like that's a very specific sort of literary tradition that is just like not my own, and I don't want to claim it as my own.
It's an excellent definition of the division and the way the term is handed about, especially in publishing marketing, is very much of something that bothers the daylights out of me, because it's not magical realism unless it's, you know, anyway, that's going to
Right, exactly.
So, next question.
That one's from me, I think. The other thing I noticed was that, especially when I read Egg Bites, but it also, like, comes across in some of the other stories as well, is there is this really conflictual report to food in your stories where it is everything that makes the world worth living in. It is all this thing that engages all the senses and that you glory in. But it's also the insidious enemy. It is the calories that you have to keep at bay in order to have a good body image. And what do you think that we can do to help detoxify body image for women and non-binary people, which is obviously, you know, a huge and very gendered concept currently?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is, I mean, I am like a fat woman who loves food. And that's its own sort of like complicated relationship, because if I'm eating the same meal next to a thin person, like somebody will like judge me for that meal and not just a thin person, which is like its own sort of complication. But I feel like the problem is that we focus so much on like body shape. It's like food is like a nourishment. It's a pleasure. It's like an aesthetic experience. And we get so focused on like bodies that we forget that like on other people's like sort of external bodies, that we sort of forget that like that what food is, like it's this pleasure. I mean, some people think food is, you know, it's funny. I keep thinking about like that amazing article. I can't remember if it was like Men's Health or something, where like the Rock was talking about his diet, and it was like he ate like 1,000 pounds of cod a year or something insane, because like he just ate cod like 8 times a day. And I remember like reading that article and thinking like, wow, that's the most awful diet I could possibly imagine. Like, it's so boring, it's so bland. And, like, again, like, he has, like, specific, like, physical things that, like, he, I love The Rock. I have a lot of thoughts about The Rock. like, he's an actor, he's, like, a bodybuilder. I mean, he has, like, specific things that he, like, needs his body to do, which is fine, and, like, he eats for that. But I don't know. I sort of feel like I feel like, you know, in that story, it's that sort of conflict of, like, being told that you have to, like, count calories. I'm like, oh, just eat, like, boiled chicken breast, like, and then you'll lose all this weight, you know, or whatever. When it's like, but what, like, when the world is so full of such pleasure and such, like, aesthetic loveliness, like, it's so hard to, like, to turn that into the enemy. It just seems so especially obscene. Yeah, and I think that story was me trying to grapple with that idea.
I mean, it comes across very strongly as, you know, that metaphor of, like, cutting away a part of your own body, becoming literal. So, you know, I sometimes feel that, yeah, people are essentially advocating that we should just cut off pleasure because that's also not a thing that we do.
Right, exactly.
That's interesting that sort of the idea of pleasure being a part of the self and a part of the body, and then having that adversarial relationship with it as a culture seems very, you know, it is definitely very Puritan in its own way.
Yep.
I think my favorite story out of the collection, I have so many, but my favorite story is Real Women Have Bodies, which has not been published online. So this is a new one.
It was published in a magazine. It does not exist anymore. And so okay. You can't find it online, which is actually good because it's been rewritten pretty heavily. So I'm glad that the original version, you can't find it anymore. But it was published on 5 chapters like years ago.
Got it. Okay. Well, suffice it to say, I adore this story. It is among my favorites for a number of reasons, but it goes with what we've been talking about versus, I mean, both the idea of stitching things together as well as sort of the fabulous nightmare. You have women who are quite literally disappearing and nobody knows why, but everybody just keeps going along. And it isn't as much about food necessarily as the story is about desire and about wanting to hold on to things literally and figuratively and yet losing things. And that idea of how body image comes into it, especially with relation to because it's always the other who is disappearing in this mm-hmm. story, but people are trying in different ways to hold on to things. It's just, it's such a fantastic piece of work. And I was just hoping you could speak to it a little bit, even though it's not technically about food.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what that story is about, I mean, it's sort of related. I feel like that story is about, it's sort of my reaction to this idea that, like, women can't be trusted
mm-hmm.
and that women disappear in all kinds of ways and we just sort of keep going. So that's literal. Like, obviously, like, women and trans women are, like, constantly being disappeared in all kinds of horrible ways. And, you know, there's only very specific circumstances under which we react with any kind of, society, like, reacts with any kind of panic. Like, if it's, like, a young, pretty, like, white teenage girl, then maybe. But, you know, usually wealthy. But if it's, like, a person of color, like, a woman of color, like, a trans woman of color, like, a sex worker, a person who served from a lower economic class, like, we just simply don't care, and we just keep going. And I think... And also, like, we sort of, women are disappeared from culture, you know, like, you know, we have, like, so, you know, women don't really get to represent themselves very much in media. They don't, you know, I mean, there's just, like, all these ways which women are absent, and we just don't, I mean, certain individual people care, certainly, but, like, if we cared as a society, it wouldn't be as bad of a problem, right? So I feel like that's just sort of the idea that I'm trying to engage with, and that I'm really interested in.
And the sensory thing that comes in is the fabric of the prom dresses in particular that are in the store, but just the way that fabric and tactility become kind of a nourishment to different characters in different ways and a way to sustain and also a way to hide things is really interesting. Like that it is, the dresses become a conduit for so many things for different characters.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I mean, as somebody who, like, I really like clothes, I'm really into fashion, I'm also fat. So, like, my relationship with, like, say, the fashion industry is complicated. Yes. And I'm really interested in the fact that fashion designers are like, oh, I love women, you know, and then they make, you know, dresses for, like, one very specific, incredibly narrow type of woman.
Right.
Those things are, don't, like, sort of, they contradict each other. But I believe in, like, the ability of, like, fashion and clothes to sort of empower and to create change and, like, shape identity. Like, I believe that those are things that are important, but that's at odds with, like, this is like the larger sort of societal ideas about clothing. So I'm really glad. And I feel like I started writing that story long before that was a thought that I really had actively in my head, but I feel like it became this repository for a lot of my ideas about women's bodies and fashion in society.
Stories sometimes tend to take the lead and then the thought follows. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, and there's also this whole, you know, subconscious bubbling going on of, like, ideas churning and then finding them ways, their ways into story when you least expect it.
Right, exactly.
We have a question that comes from the Book Smugglers. We love how you experiment with form. One of your stories is in the shape of a Kickstarter campaign. One is an episode of Law and Order. In these cases, what came first? Was it the shape or was it the content, or is it, like, more complicated than that?
In both those stories, one of which is in the collection, one of which is not, in both those cases, the form came first. I had an idea. I've been wanting to write a Kickstarter story for a while. And so John Joseph Adams approached me because he had an anthology he was doing that was literally, like, stories shaped like crowdfunders or crowdfunded campaigns. And I was like, oh, I've been wanting to try that. Sure, I'll do that. And then I wrote Help Me Follow My Sister into the Land of the Dead. And that ended up just being, like, a really cool way I got to, like, act out the thing I've been wanting to play with. I mean, sometimes it doesn't work. Like, I definitely get approached for anthologies where I'm like, oh, yeah, I have an idea for that. And then I try something with a form and I'm like, this isn't working. Or, like, I need to go at this from a different angle. But in this case, it was form first. And then Law and Order was the same thing. It was, or rather, Especially Heinous. Excuse me. So Especially Heinous, I also had this idea where I was, like, imagining a story with, like, lots of little microfictions that sort of became this scatterplot graph through which, like, a larger story was built. And I was thinking about TV, and I've been watching a lot of Law and Order SVU, and it sort of followed from there. And then the plot, I just sort of came up with the plot as I looked at the titles of the episodes. So both those cases, it was form first. That's not always the case. There definitely are stories where I start with, like, a character or something a little looser, and then, like, I eventually figure out there's a form constraint that I want to try. But yeah, in this case, it was form first.
Cool. So there's we've talked a little bit about the sort of sense of lushness and ripeness in these stories, and also the fact that many of them are liminal, and they cross literary and genre in particular as a threshold. So some of them are post-apocalyptic, they're ghost stories, they're zombie stories. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between genre and literary fiction and how each maybe uses food and bodies and desire slightly differently?
I have a lot of thoughts about, oh my God, this is like a can of worms.
No, I just opened it with another thing that I'm writing, so I'm right there with you. I'm dying to have a whole thing.
I guess I don't think of literary fiction as a genre. I think of, like, realism as a genre with all of its accompanying sort of tropes and subgenres and ideas. I think of literary as a style. And I think of it sort of as the polar opposite of, I think commercial would probably be, like, the opposite end of that that spectrum. So for me, like, genre is just about world building. It's about, like, what are the rules of this world? Like, what can a reader expect from this world? And literary is a way of writing. So it's like thinking very carefully about, like, the musicality of the language, thinking about psychology, thinking about, like, other sort of more like questions about style, right? I don't think of those things as really opposed to each other. They're just sort of like, there's, like, literary genre fiction, there's also commercial genre fiction, there's also, like, literary realism and commercial realism, right?
Yeah,
I mean, form or style. I guess style is the word that I use, sort of. Okay. But yeah, for me, the big difference is that, like, you know, with genre, you're sort of operating on both a literal and metaphorical level when it comes to the non-realist elements, right? So, like, a vampire story in, like, a literary genre story is, like, both about an actual vampire and also about something else, right? In that case, maybe like consumption or illness or loss or time or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whereas a literary realist story is going to be sort of relying a little more heavily on that sort of metaphorical element. Mm-hmm. You don't have that, like, you have like fewer genre tools at your disposal, if that makes sense. So
totally makes sense.
Yeah.
So we've got one more question, and we're going to say goodbye so you can catch a train.
Thank you.
Question is from the Book Smugglers. If you could have a dinner party with only feminists you admire, who would you invite?
Do they have to be living or dead?
Yes.
Girls work.
Yes. Oh, my God. Excuse me. That's a tremendous question. Wow. I feel like it has to be in different, like, sub-genres. I feel like I have to do, like, I want to have one dinner with, like, Roxane Gay and Mallory Ortberg and, like, Jenny Zhang. And, yeah, like, I feel like that would be, like, one dinner I would have. And then if I wanted to do, like, I feel like I'd want to have, like, a dinner with a bunch of, like, dead mid-century women writers, like Shirley Jackson and Patricia Highsmith and Jane Bowles and Muriel Sparks and Berlin. And then I want to have, like, I don't know, like a sort of dinner with, like, Helen Oyeyemi and, like, Karen Russell and Kelly Link. I mean, I feel like it just would depend on, like, which sort of feminist sort of category. That's not really, that's like, I'm cheating on all those answers, but yeah.
The good answer.
Thank you.
So where can people find you this fall?
Oh my goodness. So I have a schedule of events on my website. So if you go to CarmenMariaMachado.com, there's an events section, and I have a pretty big tour. I'm going to, I think I have like 20-ish, 25 stops, something like that. I've lost count. But yeah, I'm going to be in Philadelphia. I'm going to be in Philadelphia, San Francisco, LA, Portland, Seattle, all kinds of places. So yeah, you can go to my website and see that. And I'm going to be on Twitter at Carmen M. Machado.
I keep wanting to be like, what are you going to wear?
Oh my God, I don't even know. I mean, I have all the jumpsuits. I don't know. It's going to be great. I'm excited about my outfits. Fantastic.
When you found those jumpsuits online, I remember you exploding on Twitter and just being like, look at these things. They're the best.
Yeah. I've created quite a jumpsuit collection, which is really hilarious to me because I feel like that was never a thing I thought I would ever want from anything. But yeah, so yes, I'm going to be touring all over. So please come see me and say hi, and I will sign your book and give you a hug and whatever.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So from Elliot and me both, thank you so much, Carmen Maria Machado, for joining us with Her Body and Other Parties on Cooking the Books.
Thank you. Thank you.
This has been Cooking the Books, an interview series about food and fiction. Tune in next time for another interview.